It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a health reporter tells us that many older Americans may be taking vitamins that might not be helping their health. First, Governor Walker submitted a plan to the federal government aimed at lowering premiums for consumers who get insurance on the Affordable Care Act marketplace. Governor Walker's waiver request would reduce consumer costs by an estimated 5% if the plan is approved. Walker has traditionally been opposed to the Affordable Care Act. Our next guest is here to explain what the plan is and what it could mean for state residents who buy insurance on the marketplace. Phil Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's co-author of the book Obamacare Wars: Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here, Rob.
Well, this waiver, as I understand it, centers on the idea of reinsurance. What does that mean?
So reinsurance is like insurance for insurance companies. It is a program where a state or the federal government will pay insurance companies to cover a portion of the claims that high-cost patients experience. And so what will happen in a waiver like this is that how much insurers have to pay out in claims goes down because the state and the federal government are agreeing to pay a portion of those claims to the reinsurance fund. And the idea behind this is that if insurers are having to pay out less in claims, then they can lower premiums. And, of course, that's something that politicians, policymakers in Wisconsin have sort of noted that, you know, premiums on the Affordable Care Act marketplace, the individual market, were really high. And so the idea is that by providing some insulation against risk for insurers, you would see premiums go down. And then what would happen is, for sort of middle-class people who are buying coverage on the Affordable Care Act exchange in Wisconsin, they're not typically eligible for premium subsidies that the federal government pays out. And so what would happen is they would possibly see a direct benefit from this because they would see their premiums go down.
Can you talk about the premiums that that group of people has been facing, the people who want to be on the marketplace, but they make too much money in many cases to get those subsidies?
Yeah, the sort of background here is that insurers in marketplaces like Wisconsin and around the country, for a variety of reasons, have had to pay out a lot in claims and have charged fairly high premiums. There's been sort of double-digit premium increases in Wisconsin. For a variety of reasons, one reason is that the insurance marketplace in Wisconsin didn't attract as many sort of young, healthy people, which would make the risk pool a little bit lower and premiums a little bit lower as well. And so additionally, there have been a lot of uncertainty, in part because of the politics of the ACA. You've had this real uncertainty on the part of insurers who don't really know whether or not the federal government is going to make cost-sharing reductions. There's been reduced spending on advertising by the federal government under the Trump administration. And so all of that uncertainty has led insurers to jack up their premiums. And if you're a middle-class person and you don't or if you're not eligible for premium tax credits from the federal government, you pay most of those claims yourself.
Talking to Phil Rocco from Marquette University about a request from Governor Walker and the state government aimed at lowering health care premiums for people on individual exchanges. Phil, this reinsurance thing, it was in the original Affordable Care Act. What happened? Why isn't this already being covered, this sort of hedge for insurance companies in case the costs are higher than expected?
So this reinsurance program was initially in the Affordable Care Act, but it was in the Affordable Care Act as a temporary program that would expire and needed to be renewed by Congress after the first few years. And the idea was that within a few years, everyone who was working on passing the Affordable Care Act, I think no one really expected it would be as politically controversial as it ended up being, or that there would be as many difficult sort of implementation problems at the state level. And so I think the going wisdom was you would only need the reinsurance program for a short amount of time, and then ultimately competition between insurers would take over. And what ultimately happened was you had sort of a lot of political opposition, a lot of difficulties in implementation, and it ended up being the case that not as many insurers came into the market as folks expected they would. And so ultimately you had a push to actually fund the reinsurance program in Congress, but by that point in time, Congress was controlled by Republicans, and they opposed funding the reinsurance program. And so that's really kind of one of the reasons that states like Wisconsin and Minnesota as well, I would add, are effectively now stuck trying to make the best of a bad situation.
And Governor Walker has been an opponent of the Affordable Care Act. Wisconsin's involved in one of the lawsuits challenging the act. The state's attorney general signed on to that. Governor Walker generally supportive of that lawsuit. Are we seeing Republican governors around the state in principle opposed to the Affordable Care Act, but trying to take action to, in some ways, shore it up?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to remember that the responsibility for consumer protection in the insurance market ultimately rests with the states. And the federal government has sort of intervened in some respects over the years. But the sort of the heart of the authority to protect consumers, it's a state responsibility. And so I think you see governors kind of stepping up to the plate there. But the challenge here is pretty great, in part because it's not just about what the states do. It's about whether or not they have a good federal partner in Washington. And for the last year, I think the federal government has not been an especially helpful partner to states that are trying to make these markets work. There's been a lot of kind of conflicting signals about from the federal government about whether or not the ACA would even exist. And, of course, the individual mandate was repealed. That reduces folks' incentive to sign up for coverage, possibly increasing premiums. There's been a big reduction in advertising spending. So I do think that the governors are trying to sort of pragmatically pick up the pieces and work kind of across the aisle to make this thing work. But I think the really polarized partisan politics of the ACA at the federal level is making governors' job and state legislatures' job a lot harder. It's shifting the blame to them.
In our last minute before we wrap up, Phil, is it a slam dunk that the federal government will approve this waiver and the federal funding portion of it?
I think that the federal government has few incentives not to approve a waiver like this, especially because, I mean, one of the ideas behind this waiver is that it's going to reduce the amount of money the federal government has to pay out in premium subsidies to low-income people. It's supposed to actually save the federal government money. Now, all of that depends on whether or not enough people or the number of people that are actually projected to sign up and the number of insurers that are projected to participate actually do. So the federal government will, its interest and desire to participate in this really depends on how active states are in trying to make it work.
Phil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Philip Rocco, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. He's also co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. He joined us today to talk about the plan Governor Walker sent to the federal government aimed at lowering premiums for people on the healthcare marketplace. First, over half of Americans take some kind of nutritional supplement, things like multivitamins, fish oil, calcium, vitamin C, and more. But in many cases, there isn't a lot of research showing that the supplements are helping to prevent disease or boost health. Liz Sabo is a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News, where she focuses on acute care and end-of-life issues. Her recent piece is called Older Americans Are Hooked on Vitamins Despite Scarce Evidence They Work. Liz, welcome back to Central Time.
Nice to be here.
Well, can you talk about the scope of nutritional supplement use in the United States, especially among older adults? How many people are taking these things?
Yeah, vitamins are just incredibly popular. More than half of Americans take them. And when you look at people 65 and over, it goes up to 68%, so over two-thirds. And then among these seniors, 29% of them take four or more. So they're taking multiple vitamins.
And often over the years, doctors have recommended particular nutritional supplements to their patients. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of doctors get caught up in the hype just like patients do. And when early studies suggest that a vitamin could be a miracle cure for something, even doctors start prescribing them.
And let's get into that early study versus later research. You say that's a, you write that that's a common trend. Talk about how that ends up working out.
Yeah, well, it's pretty tricky. The way scientists work is that they typically will start with a small trial, maybe just in mice or, you know, kind of small inexpensive studies. And that's okay with a drug because if an early study suggests a drug is helpful, you and I can't go to the pharmacy and get it without a prescription. But even a small study of a vitamin could get a lot of publicity, and any of us can go out and take it. And it can often take years, maybe a decade, before really rigorous, long-term, large studies come out. And by the time that those come out, invariably they show the vitamin has no benefit, or in some cases, it's actually harmful.
Is there enough research in that longer-term research to really rule out a benefit of a vitamin, or are we in a state where there's more research needed on a lot of these things?
It depends. For some of them, you may remember a supplement called beta-carotene in the 80s. People were really excited about this one. They thought it might prevent cancer. Turns out they did some really, really large definitive studies, and it increased cancer. So nobody's recommending that. Vitamin E was the same way. People thought it was going to decrease cancer, decrease heart disease. Turns out it actually increased prostate cancer. So no one is recommending that. The door is pretty much closed on vitamin E. There's still a lot of interest in vitamin D, but a lot of the recent large randomized controlled trials, which are the gold standard of medical research, a lot of those have been negative. There's been no benefit to vitamin D for taking falls, for example, to prevent fractures in older people. Now, there is still one big study about vitamin D that is due to come out in the next year. So that will maybe give us the last word on vitamin D.
It seems kind of logical, and maybe this is what drives a lot of vitamin use, that, okay, not having vitamins we know is bad for us. Therefore, taking a particular vitamin or a multivitamin by extension must be good for us. But it doesn't pan out that way necessarily.
Right. Well, what really surprised me in doing my research for this story is to realize that just about all of us are already taking vitamins, whether we know it or not, and that's because we eat food. Virtually everything you eat these days, if it's in any way processed, has vitamins added. Your flour, when you buy enriched flour, that is enriched with B vitamins, including folic acid. Your milk, to prevent rickets, is enriched with vitamin D. Your salt is iodized. So in order to wipe out these diseases that were related to vitamin deficiency from the olden days, you know, we've been fortifying our food. So even if you're not taking a pill, your diet is already pretty heavily fortified.
I think a general sentiment is that, well, here in the United States, we have pretty bad diets. We eat a lot of junk food. Why not have a little insurance there, take that multivitamin, round things out a little bit?
Exactly. And there are some respected scientists who do still think that a multivitamin is good insurance. But as bad as our diets are, they're mostly bad in terms of getting too much fat, too much sodium, too many calories in general. I mean, I think the main problem is just too much food, too many calories. But scientists say that our diet isn't really deficient in terms of vitamins. In fact, one doctor from the National Cancer Institute said it's actually hard to avoid getting the full range of vitamins. If you think about it, even a cheeseburger, well, that cheese has got vitamin D, milk. Your fries are going to have iodine. The bun on the cheeseburger is going to have B vitamins. So our diets are really problematic, but they're not short on vitamins.
Liz Sabo is with us from Kaiser Health News. She wrote a recent piece on nutritional supplements saying many people, especially older people, are taking vitamins and other supplements that don't really have a proven track record of health benefits. And Liz, some people might hear that and say, okay, well, there's no harm in taking them. But talk about seniors in particular who you say are maybe taking four different supplements and maybe taking medications, prescription medications at the same time.
Right. Well, everyone recommends that if you go to the doctor and they ask you to tell them what medications you're taking, also, even if they don't ask, definitely tell them what vitamin supplements or herbal supplements you're taking, because some of them can have bad effects with your medications. And the other thing is, a lot of people think, well, vitamins are natural, they can't possibly cause harm. But scientists have explained to me, you know, if you think a vitamin has an effect and you're putting it in your body, then you're treating it sort of like a drug, and you should be as cautious the way you would be with a drug. And vitamins can have side effects. You know, I and a lot of women took calcium for years thinking it would protect my bones. Now studies show calcium doesn't actually help prevent falls and fractures in older people. And if anything, the calcium can give you kidney stones and cause harm.
One of the researchers you talked to, or an expert you talked to, said, well, maybe the problem is a lot of these big vitamin studies are in a 5 to 10 year time frame, and the benefits might be a longer term payoff. Is that right?
Yeah, he felt like, well, you know, maybe we need to see, a much longer study. Other researchers say, you know, we don't really have to worry about that because some of these studies are just so large. There's one called Vital that's going to be looking at vitamin D, and that's got 28,000 men and women in it. And those results should be published sometime this year. So other researchers say, you know, if there was really going to be a benefit from these vitamins with 28,000 people taking them for a number of years, we'd see some sort of signal.
There's been a lot of research on the benefits of getting vitamins from our diet. A lot of that happened here in Wisconsin, actually, originally. But one of the mysteries, it seems like, still, based on reading your article, is the fact that a vitamin is helpful when taken as a part of food. It might be a different thing, you know, as part of a diet, as opposed to we're isolating this one element of food and taking it separately.
Yeah, that's right. You know, doctors want us to be healthy, so scientists are always trying to look for the magic bullet and the secret sauce. But it can be really hard to identify what is the magical ingredient. For example, with fish, lots and lots of studies show that in populations where people eat a lot of fish, they're healthier. They have less heart disease. So everyone thought, well, it's got to be the omega-3 fatty acids that everyone's heard so much about. Well, all the studies of fish oil have pretty much been negative now that the really good, rigorous trials are coming out. And one very respected nutritionist said, you know, maybe the reason people who eat so much fish are healthier is because of what they're not eating. Maybe if they're eating salmon, they're not eating hamburgers and French fries and meatloaf.
And another thing that can confound things, you write, is that maybe a lot of the people who are able to afford and learn about vitamins and things like that, well, maybe they have access to better nutrition to begin with. How do you tease that out from the benefits of the supplements?
Exactly. It seems like for the most part, the people who take supplements are healthier and wealthier than the average person. They're very educated, so they know about the health benefits of healthy living. One woman I interviewed plays tennis 3 to 4 times a week. She's a lifelong non-smoker. She watches her weight. She's a really typical vitamin taker. The person you might think, well, maybe a vitamin could help, would be someone who has terrible nutrition and doesn't pay attention to their health. Getting those people to take a vitamin is really hard because if you can't get them to stop smoking or eat fresh vegetables, it might be hard to get them to take a vitamin. People in developing countries, that's a different story. Vitamins can be really life-saving for someone who's really starving and who's in a very nutrient-deprived environment. So all of these studies that have been done in the United States where we're all pretty well nourished, have been negative, and maybe the answer is just different depending on the population you're looking at.
Did you encounter research looking at either populations, as you were just saying, in countries that don't have access to complete nutrition, where they're just plain not getting the nutrients they need, or in places where there might be bad health habits, like you were talking about, smoking and other things, where maybe a supplement could be beneficial, we just don't know it?
Yeah. Well, I know that vitamin A is given to people in developing countries, and vitamins can absolutely be life-saving for people who are just struggling to get the basic number of calories. What's interesting is when they did the studies on beta carotene, they looked at people at really high risk of lung cancer. There was a Finnish study that looked at male smokers who were hardcore smokers or who had been exposed to asbestos. So they had the highest risk of cancer, and they thought, well, let's see if beta carotene helps them. And that's the study that found they had more cancer. And what's interesting is beta carotene is what's called an antioxidant. So is vitamin E. There's a lot of excitement about antioxidants. They seem to be terrific if you get them from food. If you're eating lots of carrots and broccoli, those nutrients seem great. When they try to give you really large doses in a pill, that's where it seems like antioxidants may be harmful. And I think a lot of people have thought that vitamins are sort of like hugs. You know, if a little is good, a lot is great. You can never have too many. Turns out maybe you can have too many. Maybe nature designed the amount of vitamin that you get in a carrot for good reason. Maybe you shouldn't really try to eat the equivalent of 50 carrots in a vitamin.
Liz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Liz Sabo, a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News, where she focuses on acute care and end-of-life issues. She joined us to talk about her recent piece on the research on nutritional supplements. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down a deportation law this week. The law allowed for the deportation of immigrants convicted of some crimes. The case saw conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch join the court's liberal members in the majority opinion. This comes before the court hears a challenge next week to the travel restrictions President Trump placed on 8 countries, most of which are predominantly Muslim. That ruling could have big implications for presidential powers over issues of immigration. Adam Liptak is a Supreme Court reporter at the New York Times. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Let's start with that deportation case. Can you give us some background on what this law would have allowed?
Sure. The law allows the deportation of people convicted of crimes of violence. But Congress, when it enacted this statute, was very vague about what it meant. And the court has struggled with how to interpret that phrase, both in the criminal context and in the immigration context. The person at the center of this case, a guy named DeMaia, had been convicted of residential burglary. Not clear whether that's a crime of violence or not. And the court said here, as in the criminal context, in the immigration context, that the law was too vague. That if Congress wants to make people eligible for deportation, it can. But it has to specify what crimes it's talking about. And so it's probably not surprising that the court's 4 more liberal members went in that direction. A bit more of a surprise that President Trump's appointee, Justice Neil Gorsuch, did. But he has a commitment to reading statutes narrowly and to calling Congress to account if it's too vague. So maybe it's not wholly surprising that you get a 5-4 decision in that direction. And there are calls for Congress to make the statute more precise, and it might well do so.
And the concern was, and it sounded like courts were reading this different ways, that burglary, well, a burglary could result in violence. And some courts were saying, okay, yeah, that fits this vague description. Other courts were saying, no, it has to actually involve actual violence.
That's exactly right. So judges had a hard time with it. And it also didn't give, the majority said, people subject to the law fair notice about what kind of conduct would get you in what kind of trouble. And for things as serious as being incarcerated or being deported, it's at least a fair point to raise that the Constitution seems to require, as a matter of due process, that you know what conduct will result in what kind of punishment.
And these are things that would fall sometimes under the purview of the Department of Homeland Security. Have they responded to this U.S. Supreme Court ruling?
They sure did, and they were plenty unhappy, and they said that this will subject communities to potential violence, and they called on Congress to fix the law to make it more precise.
Is this something that's going to end up bouncing back to lower courts, or is it up to Congress now to decide whether or not they want to fix it as the Supreme Court sees it?
Well, so going forward, it's pretty clear that this part of the law has been struck down. So if it's going to be fixed going forward, it's up to Congress. Looking backward, it's a little more complicated whether people who have been made eligible for deportation under this law can challenge that. And that will depend on all kinds of various procedural doctrines. So the courts will have a large role to play for people already subject to the law. Going forward, I think it's up to Congress.
Talking to Adam Liptak from the New York Times, looking at some immigration cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. And a big one people are watching for, Adam, the long, complicated story of these travel bans from, it was a varying number of countries. This current one, I believe, is 8 countries, mostly Muslim majority countries, 6 out of the 8. Where are we on this? This has bounced around so much.
Yeah, so we're up to the third version of the travel ban. All 3 versions challenged in the court, all 3 versions struck down in the lower courts. You'll remember that just a week after President Trump took office, he issued his first travel ban, resulting in chaos at the airports and lots of lawsuits. The second version made it to the Supreme Court, but it was dismissed as moot when the third version came in. But this third version, which is the result of some substantial interagency study and is unlike the first 2 versions meant to be permanent, now is going to face next Wednesday a Supreme Court review. And we are going to get a decision in this case and probably one that will make a major statement on the scope of presidential power in the area of immigration and national security.
And a couple unusual things in this case, it seems like. One was what Donald Trump, then candidate Donald Trump, said about banning Muslims while he was on the campaign trail, and questions about whether that matters and how we assess this particular travel ban. What's going on?
Yeah, that's quite interesting. So the government takes the view that the courts should just look at the words of the executive order, that it should ignore the context of, you know, fairly strident statements by candidate Trump about wanting to ban all Muslims, approving statements by candidate Trump about a dark moment in the nation's history when President Roosevelt sent 110,000 Japanese Americans to internment camps. And even after he's elected, he continued to, in somewhat milder ways, but nonetheless, draw connections to his earlier statements and talking about he didn't want to be politically correct, that he started to talk about territories rather than Muslims. But you sure had the sense that it was the president's intention to follow through on something like what he had promised as a candidate. Now, his lawyers say that the role of the courts is not to look behind the executive order, but just to assess it as if any president had adopted it. And that's going to be a question in Wednesday's argument about how much the court will take account of what seems to have been, at least at one point, Donald Trump's intentions.
And the main question there, I guess, then is, are these travel bans a religious bias? Is this judging people solely on the basis of their religion? Is that the question they're trying to answer them?
Yeah, so there are 2 major questions in the case. You're quite right to say one of them is this constitutional question of, does this violate the Constitution's protection of religious freedom by singling out one religious group for to disfavor that group? And the face of the executive order doesn't say that. It talks about nations. Sure, 6 of the 8 are majority Muslim. Actually, one of those 6, Chad, has recently been taken off the list. But nonetheless, the roughly 150 million people affected are very, very predominantly Muslim. Now, there are many more Muslims in the world than are in those 5 or 6 countries, but nonetheless, it disproportionately affects Muslims. So the constitutional question is this a kind of religious discrimination that violates the First Amendment's protection of religious freedom? There's a second question in the case, too, and that's the ground on which the Ninth Circuit ruled, and it's the Ninth Circuit decision that's before the court, which is Congress gives the president a lot of authority over immigration, but not unlimited authority. And the statute seemed to call for him to make findings that are based on reason and common sense. And it's the argument on the other side is that there's really no good connection between why are you excluding wholesale people from these nations and not other nations, and did Congress authorize the president to make these determinations?
We're talking to Adam Liptak, senior Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about these Supreme Court cases on immigration, the deportation argument we heard earlier, or the travel ban challenge, the discussion, the hearings coming up next week? What do you think the court should rule on the travel ban? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Adam Liptak is with us, Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times, looking at some of the court's latest moves on immigration issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this travel ban being argued before the Supreme Court next week? How are you hoping the court rules? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To your calls now, Charlie is on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I thought the reason for the countries named was not due to the religion that predominated in that nation, but rather the nation's inability to appropriately screen and vet the people who would be traveling to the United States. I mean, if it was religion, it would be based on religion, not on the ability of the country to appropriately vet the people. And all these nations have been shown and put on a list by the Obama administration as being unable to appropriately screen those people.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Adam, that's part of the argument, I believe, from the Trump administration, right?
That is the government's argument. That is supposedly the conclusion of a report the government prepared, although the report's never been made public. The other side disputes that and says, moreover, that wholesale shutting down of every national of a given country because that country doesn't supply information to the United States is not the appropriate response. But individualized vetting of people who want to come to the United States is the better approach.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Go next to George in Milwaukee. George, hi.
Yes, hi. Perhaps your guest can elucidate on this. I have heard many stories about people who are not violent criminals and perhaps have only just been arrested because they came in illegally. And I'm wondering, is the court going to be looking at this at all, not just people who have been termed violent?
George, thanks for the call. So getting back to that deportation case we mentioned, how widely will this affect how people are arrested and or deported, Adam? Or is this a pretty narrow group of people involved?
So the court looks at all kinds of immigration issues, and the caller raises an important separate question from this one. This one was looking at people, say, who are lawful residents but not citizens who commit a crime, and as a consequence of that crime may or may not be deportable depending on how serious the crime is. The separate question of whether people who are not authorized to be here in the first place, which of them should be deported and when and how long can they be held in immigration detention and while those decisions are made, that's the subject of a whole separate set of cases, and the court has an active immigration docket. There are many immigration laws, and it's looking hard at them, and it has gone both ways on them. So just in February, the conservative majority of the court, in that instance joined by Justice Gorsuch, said that people seeking asylum in the United States, say, or fighting their deportations, say, can be held for very long periods of time in immigration detention and are not entitled to bail hearings to be released on bond, even if they're not a threat to the community or a threat of flight. So the court has an active immigration docket, and it's trying to fine-tune all these laws.
George, thanks a lot for that call. Adam, I wanted to ask about something you mentioned earlier. You mentioned the president referring to the Japanese internments during World War II, Japanese-American internments, I should say. And I think it was one of your pieces you pointed out that was approved by the U.S. Supreme Court at the time, generally looked back on as one of the worst U.S. Supreme Court decisions in history, but it's never been overturned. It could still theoretically be used as precedent.
That's right. So President Roosevelt issued an executive order in 1942 that led to the internment of more than 110,000 Japanese Americans, most of them American citizens, and that's a dark moment in the nation's history. In 1944, in a case called Korematsu, the court said that was okay, and these days almost everybody thinks that Korematsu ranks with the very worst Supreme Court decisions, ranks with Dred Scott and Plessy v. Ferguson. And so it was a little bit of a surprise early in President Trump's candidacy in December of 2015 when he spoke approvingly of that episode. He didn't talk about the Supreme Court decision, but it's, as you say, Rob, it is still on the books. I don't think the court would ever cite it, but nor has it ever overruled it.
And I wanted to get into, before we run out of time, speculation about a Supreme Court retirement. We're kind of always playing this game, it seems like, but there's talk about Justice Kennedy maybe retiring this year. What are you looking at? What are the odds makers saying about this?
You know, last year when it looked like last year it seemed very much on the table. He's since settled into his role a little bit more. He's retained his decisive vote on the court, which he would have lost had Hillary Clinton become president. He's 81 years old, and it's certainly possible, but I think the odds are a tiny bit lower now than they were last year. And if I had to bet, I bet he'd stick around. But should Justice Kennedy go, it will be a transformative moment for the court because he has cast the deciding vote for so long. And if President Trump gets to replace him, he'll replace a moderate conservative who not infrequently votes with the liberals in cases like on gay rights and abortion and affirmative action with a hardcore conservative, and that will move the court substantially to the right.
Right. No one would appoint another Justice Kennedy. It seems like a Democrat would try to get somebody way to the liberal side of things, Republican the other way around. Is a Supreme Court justice thinking about that? They're not going to, my view won't be represented if I leave?
Political scientists say they do try to take account of that. It's a little hard to game your retirement just right. And as you say quite correctly, Rob, Kennedy's in a particularly tough spot because it's not like you can wait around for the next president and know that that's going to be pretty close to where you are ideologically. He's sort of in this middle ground, and polarized America no longer exists.
And it's kind of a weird institution that we have people in their 80s postponing retirement maybe indefinitely.
That's right, and he's not the oldest justice. Justice Ginsburg is 85. Justice John Paul Stevens worked until he was 90. And so you have people who are sort of legacies of an entirely different historical era. Justice Kennedy was appointed by Ronald Reagan, and yet he's still the most important vote on the most important court in the nation.
We'll leave it there for now. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was great to be here.
Adam Liptak is a Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times. He was getting us up to speed on immigration cases coming before the court, the big travel ban argument coming up next week, plus speculation that Justice Anthony Kennedy could retire this year. He says he doesn't think that's going to happen. Over the last week, wildlife groups around the state have been getting reports of starving and dying robins, purple martins, and other species traveling north for the spring. The songbirds have been hobbled by the unseasonable weather. Snow has made it hard for the birds to catch insects or search for other food. Marge Gibson is the executive director of the Raptor Education Group, Incorporated. She talked to Central Time producer Jay Carlisle Larson about the problem.
Marge, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What is the scope of the problem right now as you're seeing it?
Well, it's very difficult now. The birds that are coming up are basically insect eaters, and this is their normal time to migrate into our area. It's just our weather that's abnormal, unfortunately, and they're caught in a very difficult situation. They are the early migrators, and so they do have a little flexibility, especially robins, but they do need to reach soil to be able to have some access to some sort of invertebrate that's in the soil, and that's not possible. We still have 3 feet of snow up here, and it's still been very, very cold.
Now, as you just said, this is the early sort of waves of this migration, but as you've been dealing with birds that are in distress, how significant of an impact is this going to have in the next couple of weeks?
Well, it started off we were wondering what was happening. We saw a few robins come in, but we thought maybe they had been a flock that came and they would go back south. But unfortunately, south was also not very safe for them at that point because this inclement weather has been happening, for most of the Midwest. So we then started getting many calls about robins being on the ground. And people being able to walk up to them and pick them up. And that, of course, is very alarming. If you can walk up to a wild bird and pick it up, it definitely is having problems and needs to be taken to a rehab center. And that's we started getting the word out. Then we started hearing even worse things, robins at roost, nighttime roosts, and people were trying to feed them and do provide them with some insects and, you know, dried mealworms and things like that, and finding 50, 60 of them dead overnight. So it's pretty devastating.
And what are some of the symptoms, or what are you seeing these birds when they are coming in? What are they displaying?
Well, the public first sees what they think is a very fat robin or a warbler or one of the even killdeer. We've had killdeer come in too. And they're very fluffed up. And so people presume that means they're very fat. And, of course, it's the actual opposite. They puff up when they're trying to keep warm. It's like their version of our layers in cold weather. And they try to get air caught between their feathers so they can maintain heat. Then they tuck their head under their wing during the daytime. They're not really sleeping. They're just really in desperate straits, and that's those are the signs that people see. They try to eat at feeders, but they're not really eating. They're just sort of going through the motions.
You said that people have been able to just walk up and pick up some of these birds. For people who are worried about a bird that they think is in distress, first, what should they be on the lookout for, and what should they do in this situation?
Well, if you have a flock of robins or warblers or any of the insect eaters in your area, you can provide food, obviously, the best food you can. Sometimes it's crumbled up suet cakes that have little insects in them. The suet itself is very high calorie and high protein, of course. So those things are good. Dried mealworms, things like that. If you're supplying that at your feeder or on the ground around your feeder, that's good. So if they're just a flock there and they look hungry and they are eating, that's the best thing you can do. You can open up areas, move snow away from areas so there is ground exposed so they can start having some natural exposure to their own elements. Those are good things. Also, keep your dog and cat indoors because these birds are compromised, and they're very easy to become prey to something like a dog or a cat.
Marge, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're most welcome.
That was Marge Gibson, Executive Director of the Raptor Education Group, Incorporated. She talked to Central Time producer J. Carlisle Larson about how the unseasonable snow and cold is impacting migrating songbirds and what people can do to help. Have you seen this problem in your part of the state with the two mid-April snowstorms we've had just over the course of the last week? Have you brought birds to rehab or tried to feed them yourself? Do you work in bird rehab yourself? We'd love to hear from you. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org, or you can message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Again, let us know if you're seeing these problems with birds after this unseasonable April snow. I have some good news and bad news if you want to be on the TV. The good news, a major TV show put out a casting call for extras to appear in an episode filmed in Wisconsin. Bad news, between the time I saw it yesterday and when I checked in today, they were already full up. They're not looking for any more. The show is American Gods, the modern-day mythology show on the network Starz. They're filming an episode in the Spring Green area. They had a notice up looking for extras. As of this afternoon, if you go to sign up, you get this. Hi, everyone. Thank you for the overwhelming response. We've reached our submission limit for this project. Sorry. Now, here's what I think they're filming. I haven't watched the show American Gods, but I have read the book it's based on by Neil Gaiman. There's a key scene in the book where ancient Norse gods hold a really important gathering at House on the Rock in Spring Green. Here's Neil Gaiman back in 2010 at the House on the Rock talking to Steve Paulson from To the Best of Our Knowledge about how the unique tourist site inspired the book American Gods.
I think one of the things that's so brilliant about the House on the Rock is that it creeps up on you gradually. The transition between somewhere that's kind of weird and I'm not even sure I'm on planet Earth anymore is this carousel. And you look at it and you realize there are no horses on it. Everything on it is like a child's fever dream nightmare.
Missed your chance to be on the show, but you can read the book and I guess watch the episode when it comes out, probably sometime next year. This is Central Time.